Can you hear me?
Yeah, is that you, Lieutenant Governor?
It is. Is that Ed?
Yes, it is.
Okay. We're waiting for the no side. I think it's going to be Denny.
Okay.
But, maybe Ken.
And do we know if we have any, is there any public there in Ketchikan, or do we have anyone online?
We do have the Ketchikan Daily News here, and I don't think we have anybody else online at present.
Okay, all right. And, Mead, I don't know if you got my email the other night, but I misspoke when I said the BC minimum wage. I'll correct that when I'm on the record there.
Great.
I checked myself later, and I ran into Vince that night at the airport and told him of my error.
Well, you had said it was something like 10.75, and it's 10.
I said I thought it was 12 and a half, and it turns out it's in BC it's only 10.35. It's 11 in Ontario, but so I didn't want that error to go uncorrected, and I'll do that when I start my presentation.
Okay.
Howdy, guys. This is Denny. I'm on.
Hey, Denny. How are you?
I'm doing well. Mead, how you doing?
Good.
How you doing, Ed?
Good, Denny. I'm up in Anchorage going back to Juneau tonight. How you doing?
Well, I'm in Juneau, and I wish you well. It's been a little foggy in the morning.
Oh.
I'm supposed to go to Anchorage via Juneau tomorrow night. And overnight in Juneau, and it'll be interesting to see if we get home in time.
You may get the opportunity to go right straight home.
That could work.
Never works that way when you want it to.
or I could get the opportunity to be stuck in Juneau and go see if we can catch some Peter Kings.
Yeah.
All right, we're just about ready to get started. We'll give it another 30 seconds.
Is not plugged in at this point. I can turn on the...
Hey, can I ask you guys before we get started, are we in agreement or not in agreement on how many people are affected by this bill, directly, indirectly, and so forth? I guess we have a number from the Department of Labor about the number of people whose jobs are only minimum wage, and then there's a second number, which is the number of people whose jobs now pay closer to $9.75, and then there's the indirect number. And,
that's correct. And just to clarify, since those are numbers I've presented, the first two numbers are from the Department of Labor, and that second one, Mead, is that they project on the effective date of the 975 rate, January 2016, there would be 28,000 Alaskan workers making that or less. And then the indirect number comes from a different study by the Economic Policy Institute, and projected the number of workers in that kind of shadow, a dollar over 975. That's the 20,000 number. But that is not a Department of Labor number.
Okay.
I don't have any arguments with them.
Yeah, this is Joe Dunham. I just for clarification, threw out a couple that I'm not sure are counted or not. A day or two ago when we were here, school bus drivers have to get paid twice minimum wage. Exempt employees have to be paid on a salary basis that's equal to twice minimum wage. Most of the exempt employees probably make more than that anyway. It's really not clear as far as who that would affect, but they are tied to the minimum wage.
And to that point, and I don't want to belabor that, we did have discussion, but when we're talking about affected, we're talking about workers affected by minimum wage, low wage workers affected. Those school bus drivers or exempt employees, while their wage is certainly based on a reference to the minimum wage, I mean, we've never purported them to be minimum wage or low wage workers that, you know, we have been talking about being affected by this act. So they're outside, you know, they're outside of that 48,000 total direct and indirectly affected number that we've presented all along. We're talking about the minimum wage for workers working at the minimum wage, not higher wage based on it.
Okay. All right. We're about to convene. Let me just check real fast. Do we have, Michaela, do you have everybody's PowerPoint?
I'm moving.
Okay.
Okay, you ready for me to turn on the mic?
Yep. And then, yes. And then, well, I can hear fine. Can other people hear what's on this, or do we aim that mic at that? Or
they should be able to hear through the sound system. People that have called in before have been able to hear.
Okay.
For assembly meeting.
Okay. Hey, just to help Tina and Matt and Mr. Mayor, Ed, can you count to five?
One, two, three, four, five.
Can you hear Commissioner Flanagan?
Yeah, we can certainly. I thought you were asking if they would be able to hear you.
Yeah. Okay. Ed, count to three this time.
One, two, three.
Okay, good. All right, thank you. Denny's on the line, yeah. Great. Okay, could I ask before we get started, who's on the line now? I know we have Ed Flanagan and Denny, and who else is on the line?
This is Joe Dunham, Supervisor of the Wage and Hour Administration, Department of Labor. I'm on.
And Dan Robinson, Department of Labor, Research and Analysis Chief.
And Anna Latham, Legislative Liaison, Department of Labor.
Thank you. All right, and just for the information of those on the phone here in the room, we've got five individuals besides myself. We have Michaela Gertson and Barbara Probst and our Lieutenant Governor's office, Bob Weinstein, who's former mayor, and in Senator Begich's office, Tina Williams, who's publisher of the Ketchikan Daily News, and Matt, I've forgotten your last name.
Armstrong.
What we will do with this hearing is move through fairly quickly. There may be others who call in, and I'm going to convene this public hearing on Ballot Measure 3, an act to increase the Alaska minimum wage. This hearing is part of a series of eight hearings that are required by law for the Lieutenant Governor to hold around the state. We've had hearings so far in Nome, Barrow, and Juneau, and after this hearing, we'll have hearings in Anchorage, Mat-Su, in Wasilla, and Bethel and Fairbanks. And our agenda today is very simply to go through sectional analysis, summary, and cost estimate of the bill, presentation by the pro side, which will take 10 minutes, presentation by the con side, which will take 10 minutes, and then an invitation for public testimony, where individuals will have a chance to ask questions of the experts online. The summary of the proposed bill. This bill would increase Alaska's minimum wage from $7.75 an hour to $8.75 an hour, effective January 1st, 2015, and to $9.75 an hour, effective January 1st, 2016, and thereafter adjust the minimum wage annually for inflation. It would create a method for annual inflation adjustment, but if that method does not yield a state minimum wage that is at least $1 higher than the federal minimum wage, it would require the minimum wage to be at least $1 higher than the federal minimum. Tips or gratuities would not count toward the minimum wage. The two-page act would repeal and reenact Alaska Statutes 23.10.065A and would require that the minimum wage in Alaska be raised by $2 in two installments over the next 2 years from $7.75 to $9.75 by January 1st, 2016. And it provides a method for calculating an annual adjustment for inflation after 2016. And if the minimum wage determined by the proposed annual adjustment method is less than $1 over the federal minimum wage, the Alaska minimum wage shall be set at $1 over the Alaska federal minimum wage. Now, just to clarify what an initiative is and how it works, this is a proposal to write a law that was submitted by citizens, by three sponsors, it was duly placed on the ballot with the appropriate number of signatures. If the voters of Alaska pass it, we will certify the election return as being passed, and an initiated law becomes effective 90 days after certification. A law like this is not subject to a governor's veto, and it may not be repealed by the legislature within 2 years of its effective date, according to the Alaska Constitution, Article 11, Section 6. And although the legislature may amend an initiative at any time after it's enacted, any amendments made during the first 2 years may not operate to effectively repeal the initiative by amendment or vitiate the intent. And there have been several legal cases on this that have helped clarify that in the law. The cost estimate for the bill to the state directly is rather minimal, but we have prepared a cost estimate which is available on the table for people to look at. The Office of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development estimates a cost of $2,083 to print 10,000 posters on child labor, knowing your rights, and the summary of the Wage and Hour Act. It's my understanding that distribution of those posters will happen under the current budget, and it's not an incremental deal, there's also 1,500 Alaska fishing industry brochures that would need to be printed to reflect the new information in this law. And then the cost to the Office of the Lieutenant Governor and Division of Elections, the share that this initiative has in this round, the state initiative on hearings, we estimate $9,000. It's actually going to cost us less because we have three initiatives on the ballot at once, but when we prepare the cost estimate, we prepare it kind of for each initiative that's out there. And then likewise, the initial cost of initiatives on the ballot is about $71,000. And again, because we have three initiatives on the ballot, I'm sure we're not going to spend $210,000 additionally, but I wanted to make sure that we were covered with that cost estimate, whether we had one initiative, two or three. And that had been a question at the time that this was put forward. With that, I'm going to now invite Ed Flanagan, one of the sponsors of the initiative, and Ed, I'm going to ask you to identify your organization to present the pro side. We've got about 10 minutes reserved for you, and we'll go from there.
Thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. I'm Ed Flanagan. I'm the chair of Alaskans for a Fair Minimum Wage. We are the initiative sponsor group formed under the under Alaska law to pursue this initiative, to get the signatures, to get it on the ballot, and now to wage a campaign to have it passed by the voters and enacted. Before I start my presentation, I know the Lieutenant Governor is keeping an open running record on this. I need to correct a misstatement I made in the hearing in Juneau on Monday during an exchange with Captain O'Shea of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. I stated that I thought the minimum wage in British Columbia was $12 or $12.50. And after the hearing, something about that, I thought maybe it was more 11 or 11.50. And when I checked, I had overstated it by $2 possibly. It is $10.35 an hour in BC. It's 11 in Ontario and one other province. But the British Columbia minimum wage is $10.35. So I want to make that correction. And now I'll just go ahead.
Ed, is that converted to U.S. dollars or Canadian dollars?
No, that is in Canadian. So if you converted it to U.S. dollars as of that day when I was looking it up on Wikipedia, it would be, I believe, 923 American. So get to the presentation here. Again, apologize for that. It was not part of prepared. It was just something off the cuff and a discussion that, you know, ensued from the presentations or from the testimony. So ballot measure 3 will be on the November 4th ballot. We'll go to the first, the second slide after the cover, please, that shows what does ballot measure 3 do. I don't have to belabor that because the Lieutenant Governor accurately described the main points of the bill. It's rather simple, rather very straightforward. I just would talk about maybe what it doesn't do. It doesn't raise the minimum wage to $12 or $15 an hour. It's a modest proposal, $8.75 and $9.75 over, well, the next 15, 16 months at this point. It doesn't change an existing exemption in Alaska's minimum wage law for youth that are under the age of 18 who work 30 hours or less. They are actually excluded from coverage by the Alaska minimum wage law and are only covered by the federal minimum wage law. So we do nothing to change that. And one other thing we do, because it's a repeal and reenact, we do restate the longstanding ban on a so-called tip credit in Alaska, whereas in many states, and even under federal law, waiters and waitresses can be paid as little as $2.13 an hour if tips are sufficient to reach the minimum wage. Alaska's never had that, and we reaffirm the ban on that, longstanding ban on that. So just briefly, a little background. Alaska was actually the first state to institute its own state minimum wage higher than the federal, and our first legislature did that in 1959. The federal at the time, federal minimum wage was $1. First legislature said, well, in Alaska it's going to be $1.50 because it's a lot more expensive to live here. And then the next year, or maybe it was the year after, there might have been an increase in the federal, and they just said, okay, well, from now on we're 50 cents over. At first it was just a flat $1.50, but then it referenced and said it, whatever the federal is, we're going to be 50 cents higher. And that kept Alaska the highest minimum wage in the country, which is certainly congruent with its highest cost of living in the country, for 32 or 33 years after statehood. Then, and other states had started to adopt their own minimum wages, especially in the 80s when there was no minimum wage increase for about a 9-year period. It had been done about every 5 years on a bipartisan basis in Congress on the federal level, but things kind of got stuck in the 80s, and since then it has lost a lot of ground, the federal minimum wage. And with the Alaska being tied to it for most of that time, also the since statehood, also the Alaska minimum wage. Now, significant change in 2001, Governor Knowles introduced a bill to raise the state minimum wage to the current $5.65, which was 50 cents over the then federal $5.15, to $7.15, and do it in two stages, just like our bill does. And then, for the first time, institute a cost of living adjustment. And the cost of living adjustment, like in our bill, is figured that when you do the annual adjustment, if it turns out that that adjustment by the Anchorage CPI, cost consumer price index, the only one available for the state and the one commonly used in labor agreements and many state formulas, if that amount did not end up being $1 rather than 50 cents over the federal, then $1 over the federal would be the rate. And then the next year, the CPI, that thing, if it ever took effect, it would probably only be once that the dollar would be a factor because Alaska will have the CPI every year. The legislature didn't really act much, really didn't move it out of first committee in the first session 2001, so the AFL-CIO got 50,000 signatures, got a ballot measure virtually identical to the bill, approved for the November 2002 ballot. In the 2002 session, the legislature all of a sudden got interested in moving the bill and passed a virtually identical, as required by state law, to preempt. In a case like this where it's something with specific dollar amounts, it was determined that it had to be virtually identical to moot the initiative. They passed that in May of 2002, and because there had been one session lost, it was all to take effect 7 months later on January 1st, 2003. Effectively, one jump, a $1.50, 27% increase. That did take effect. The legislature, unfortunately, in May of 2003, before there had ever even been a utilization of the cost of living index, repealed the cost of living factor. So the even 18 legislators who had voted for it the year before then voted to gut it in 2003. So Alaska's minimum wage, it was the highest in the country again at 7.15. It stayed at 7.15 until 2009, when the federal minimum wage was actually due to surpass ours and go to 7.25. So the legislature added a dime in 2009 and said in January 1st of 2010 we'll go back to 50 cents over federal. And that's where we are now. That was the last increase. January 1st, 2010, we went to 7.75, and that's where we sit now. Now, if we look at minimum wages in states higher than the federal rate, you'll see that Alaska, we don't necessarily have to be number one. Actually, we're not number one in as a state in cost of living. We're number four. But as folks in Ketchikan and just about any place but Anchorage realize, we get away from Anchorage, that differential where, you know, our cost of living.
It's not like you're talking about Connecticut.
I'm sorry, what's that?
I didn't interrupt you. There was somebody else online.
Okay.
Yeah, I apologize.
All right, well, I'll try and wrap it up here. Anyway, we're down to 19th place. I'm sorry, please move to the next slide. You'll show that District of Columbia's up there, but Washington State at 932 is the highest in the country. We are now 19th place. We're even behind low cost of living states like Florida and Arizona. Had the legislature not repealed the CPI provision in 2003, we would have gone up an average at 23 cents a year and with the cost of living, and we'd be 953 today. We'll skip through the next slide. That just confirms what I showed, that we're now fourth in terms of highest cost of living, and our minimum wage, with the exception of Hawaii, which is in the process also of raising theirs, we're a lot lower than most of those other states. Now, this next slide I want to spend a little time on, because every time you raise the minimum wage or propose doing it, there are predictions from a lot of folks, whether it's from certain industries, from conservative economists or other folks, that, you know, you're going to kill jobs, you're going to throw people out of work. Well, in Alaska, we had on January 1st, 2003, the largest ever single jump in a minimum wage in any jurisdiction in the U.S. And here's what actually happened. This is looking at the Department of Labor's total non-farm wage and salary employment, as an expressed as it is, by as an average monthly, for the year 2002 as opposed to 2003. So you had an increase, 27% increase with 7 months' notice that it was going to take effect. And in 2003, employment grew 1.5% for all jobs, 1.7% for the private sector. Monthly wages was about the same, 1.7 in total employment, 1.5 in the private sector. That was in line with what happened the years prior and the years after. And if you look at the four industries employing the most low-wage workers, as identified by the Department of Labor in a March 29th hearing, seafood processing, retail trade, accommodation, hotels, food service, and drinking places, you'll see that was growth in all but one case of retail trade equal to or substantially greater than the employment growth in the Alaskan economy as a whole, and that wages, for the most part, were up significantly in those, obviously because of the minimum wage. So it's a 27% increase, and what happened, the quantity of jobs went up, the quality of those jobs in terms of pay for the people at the lower end went up. Who is affected by this? What minimum wage or low wage workers are affected, will be affected? The Department of Labor has identified a very low number of workers actually making the minimum wage, or maybe in some cases less because they're in exempt categories, of less than 3,000. And we would say that is just more proof that the minimum wage has ceased to perform its function. But 28,000 workers, the department projects, will be making less than $9.75 an hour when the second raise takes effect and would thus automatically get a raise. Now, the next number, the 20,000 indirect, does not come from the Department of Labor. It comes from a study by the Economic Policy Institute, but it is very common when you increase the minimum wage to project, and experience shows that folks at sometimes it's much as $2 over the amount you're raising it to. But this is a conservative estimate by the Economic Policy Institute projecting workers that will be making up to $1 more than $9.75. That shows 20,000 workers affected. So that's a total of 48,000 workers, Alaskans, affected by this, 48,000 families. They're not all teenagers. In fact, a vast majority of them are 20 and over. Of those 48,000, Economic Policy Institute projects that 78% are 20 or over, 57% are women, 25% have children. The next slide is pretty busy. I'm just going to describe it real briefly. That was a recent study using BLS statistics by the Center for Economic Policy Research. It looked at the last 5 months of last year, the first 5 months of this year, and what it was looking at was the states, well, it shows all the states, but the states, the 13 that raised their minimum wage, 12 of them because they have a CPI increase, and those are generally pretty small increases. And then Jersey, which had a large increase because of a November ballot, in all but Jersey, the employment went up, and in most cases over the national average. Now, this is one important point. Some folks will say, well, the costs are just going to be passed on to the consumer, and in some cases, some part of them certainly will be. But what we like to point out to folks, and a lot of folks, you know, point this out to us, we're already paying, we're already subsidizing the wages of low-wage employers. Now, public assistance for Walmart employees, I'm not picking on Walmart, they just happen to be the largest employer in the country, and they employ a lot of low-wage workers. Their employees, 1.1 million of them, get $6.2 billion annually in taxpayer-funded public assistance, Medicaid, Earned Income Tax Credit, and food stamps. That averages $6,000 per employee. If you figure that conservatively, I think, half of their employees make living wage jobs and don't need public assistance, I would hope half do, that's $12,000 per employee. We're already paying. For fast food industry, almost $7 billion paid in those benefit public assistance programs. 52% of families of frontline fast food workers are enrolled in one or more public assistance programs versus 25% of the workforce as a whole. In the interest of time, I will skip the next slide on earned income tax credit. If it comes up, we can talk about it. And just to put this in real life, real-world context, what does it mean? What does it mean for a single parent with two kids who's trying to at least get up to and maybe exceed the federal poverty level? Instead of working 61 hours a week at the current minimum wage, that mom or dad would now only have to work 49 hours a week. Still a lot of time. They're working in some of our hardest occupations, but there's potentially, they'll probably just work more hours trying to get ahead, but there's the potential for having 12 additional hours to help kids with homework and maybe get some training for themselves. Again, they're more likely to get more hours or get a second job, but I'll just leave it at that for now, and thank you again for this opportunity. And wish I could be there personally in Ketchikan. I spent the 3 days before Thanksgiving collecting signatures in the mall there and had a great response from people in Ketchikan, including at least one and two business owners from the mall came down and signed, as we saw in other parts of the state, saying, I don't see how anybody could expect to pay people less than $10 an hour in this town. Even that would be low. And we got a lot of signatures, a lot of strong support. Folks in Ketchikan really understand this issue and need to do this. And we really appreciated that and the warm welcome we had there. Thank you very much.
Commissioner Flanagan, thank you very much. And now I'd like to invite Danny DeWitt with the National Federation of Independent Business to present the con side on this. And Danny, feel free to introduce yourself and the organization however you would like.
Lieutenant Governor, thank you for the opportunity to offer testimony in opposition to Proposition 3 on the November ballot. My name is Denny DeWitt, and I'm the State Director for the National Federation of Independent Business in Alaska. We represent about 2,000 small businesses in Alaska, typically referred to as the mom-and-pop shops. We oppose Proposition 3 as it is not in the best interest of the Alaskans it's intended to affect. Make no mistake, should Prop 3 pass, it would have two immediate effects, but not the one supporters would have you believe. First, teenage unemployment will increase over time, reducing their chances of getting valuable work experience. Prop 3 supporters point to Washington State as an example that Alaska should follow. In 2013, both states had similar unemployment rates, 6.5% in Alaska and 7% in Washington, But for young adults ages 16 to 19, the situation was much different. In Alaska, where the minimum wage is $7.75 an hour, teen unemployment was 17.5%. In Washington State, where the minimum wage is $9.32 an hour and rises every year because of indexing to inflation, the teen unemployment rate was an astounding 30.6%. In Oregon, where the minimum wage is $9.10, the teen unemployment rate is 27.4%. A loss of opportunity at the bottom rungs of the career ladder is concerning, not just because teens miss out on spending cash, but also teens who miss out on early career experience are at a distinct disadvantage. For example, research has found that high school seniors with part-time jobs are earning higher wages 6 to 9 years after graduation than their counterparts who didn't. Lengthy spells of unemployment have also shown to increase the risk of future unemployment for young people. In this regard, the last thing Alaska should be trying to do is emulate the youth unemployment rates in Oregon and Washington State. And while we do have an exemption for teenagers who work 30 hours in specified non-dangerous type jobs, that's really not the issue. The issue is whether or not the expenses caused to a business in its aggregate by this leaves any money available to hire those entry-level jobs where you bring teens in and teach them how to be an employee, teach them about the business. So it's how the future jobs and those entry-level jobs are treated in terms of the affordability generally that really is the problem. Data shows also that families earning at least three times the poverty level are more likely to benefit from these kinds of increases than those earning below it, making the minimum wage increase really a lousy anti-poverty initiative. These results are not a matter of speculation, but economic patterns that have followed every increase in the minimum wage. It's vital that voters know the truth about minimum wage. About 99% of all hourly wage workers in Alaska, it's about 3,000 FTE jobs, already earn above the minimum wage. More than 50% of the minimum wage workers are under age 24. So raising the rate removes that first rung of the economic ladder of life for young adults, as business owners are forced to cut back on hiring in order to meet cost increases. After the last federal increase in the minimum wage, 500,000 teen jobs disappeared following the following 6 months. And that was in a period of economic recovery when more jobs should have been available. The average annual family income of those earning minimum wage nationally was over $48,000. Significantly more people earning at least three times the poverty level will benefit as those living beneath it. 83% of minimum wage earners are teenagers living with working adults, adults living alone, or dual income couples. What happens when the minimum wages rise too high? Remember filling station attendants? How about baggers in the grocery stores? Or for us older folks, ushers in movie theaters? All have been eliminated. Technology may do the same for today's minimum wage jobs. Placing orders through touch screens and self-checkout is growing in Alaska. Losing these jobs means losing the bottom rung on the career ladder and fewer opportunities for the people who used to fill those jobs. Of course, other factors besides minimum wage can determine teen unemployment rate. But a careful look at the data shows that a higher minimum wage has played a role. Using data from 2005 to 2011, economists from Miami and Trinity Universities estimated that over 4,300 fewer teen jobs in Washington State due to the higher minimum wage. One article in the Seattle Weekly provided a striking example of how these jobs are eliminated. restaurants in the state's largest city have generally stopped hiring bussers in restaurants, opting to have the servers bus their own tables instead. And they are scheduling fewer servers per shift due to the higher cost. These consequences are broadly consistent with what we see in the economic research on minimum wage increases. Since the early 1990s, roughly 85% of the most credible academic studies on this subject show that a higher minimum wage reduces employment for the least skilled and the least experienced employees. That doesn't mean that there aren't outliers, but they're in the distinct minority. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office understood this, and that's why it estimated 500,000 lost jobs nationwide from the proposed federal minimum wage increase to $10.10. But the unfortunate reality we must recognize is that small employers, those most affected by the minimum wage, cannot support employees that are not bringing to the business a value equal to their compensation. We are providing unemployment insurance, workers' comp insurance, and Social Security employer tax at a minimum in addition to the basic salary. In addition, over half these employers are providing additional benefits such as health insurance. As these total employee costs increase, businesses look to mechanization and computerization in order to stay in business and not in the employment of all its employees at any compensation level. Given the reality of whom the proposed increase in the minimum wage will hurt, the young starting their lives and the seniors in the sunset of their lives, we can only hope and recommend that Alaskans vote no on this perhaps well-meaning proposal. It's not the intention that we're voting on. It's the actual effect on the young and the old. An economist, William J. Dennis, who's been studying small businesses and the minimum wage for nearly 40 years, asks, quote, "Employers want experienced workers. How do you get experience when you price people out of the market in the first place?" Thank you for the opportunity to share our position with you.
Danny, thank you for your testimony. I would like to ask a couple of fast questions before we open up to public testimony or public questions if we have any. Ed, in your testimony, you talked about the tip credit. And just because I don't have the the current statute in front of us now, is the tip credit language the same as it is in current law, or is there any change in the tip credit issue?
There's no change whatsoever, Lieutenant Governor.
Okay. And the issue of the CPI for the Anchorage metropolitan area, we've had that explained to us in hearings other places in the state that that's the only place where the Bureau of Labor Statistics does that. Dan Robinson online with the Department of Labor. Is there any state which has a minimum wage that varies by region of a state? Or perhaps based on a different CPI for different parts of a state?
Not that I know of, although there are lots of local governments that have boundary-specific unemployment rates.
Unemployment rates, but not necessarily...
I'm sorry. Minimum wage legislation, and the SeaTac area is one. Cities are increasingly moving to change minimum wage law.
Okay. All right. And then you stated before the hearing convened, and I'm going to ask, I think it was you, it might have been Joe, stated, can you tell us what other jobs you're aware of that may be paid higher than minimum wage but are set by the minimum wage?
Yeah, that was Joe. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, I haven't done a full research on it. I know that school bus drivers and public schools, for public school bus drivers, are required to get 2 times the minimum wage. So theirs would automatically go up. I mean, their minimum rate, and that's by statute. That's in the same statute as the minimum wage. That's paragraph B, 2310.065. an exempt employee being paid on a salary basis, the minimum salary requirement for those exempt employees is 2 times the current minimum wage based on a 40-hour work week. But they're paid on a salary basis, but there's a minimum salary requirement.
So to clarify that, if I had a person in my employ who was on salary, and that person works 40 hours a week, you divide that salary, that weekly salary, by 40 hours, and if it's less than the minimum wage, twice the minimum wage, then he can't really be considered a salaried employee. It has to be considered an hourly employee.
Yes. The minimum salary requirement is twice minimum wage based on 40 hours, which is $620 a week. In order to be an overtime exempt employee, that salary has to reach that minimum. So if the minimum wage change goes up to $9.75, then, hold on, $9.2 times 40, then the minimum salary instead of $620 would be $780 a week. Twice
okay.
minimum wage based on a 40-hour work week.
Okay. And then, Ed, there was one question based on your testimony where you said that the minimum wage today would be $9.53 if COLA had stayed in. Was that based on the 2001 legislation that passed where the COLA was taken out of the legislation?
That's correct, Lieutenant Governor, and the CPI COLA language is the same in our bill, but no, that's based on if the legislature had left intact the bill they passed in 2002, that's $7.15 an hour through annual adjustments. The dollar over federal would never have, well, let's see, the dollar over federal would barely have been a factor maybe in 2009. I don't have the year-by-year progression according to the CPI, but in 2009, the federal went up to 725, and I think by that, I guess right around Alaska probably would have been about 825 by then, because that was about 5 years ago, and it would be 953 today. But I can't say for sure, but I don't believe the dollar would have ever even been a factor, and we'd be at 953 solely based on the annual inflation since then in the formula spelled out in that bill and duplicated in our initiative.
Okay. Has there ever been a COLA in the minimum wage laws of the state before this?
No, sir.
Okay. And then just looking at the draft language that you've provided in the initiative, you say the department shall round the adjusted minimum hourly wage up to the nearest 1 cent. And that applies to work performed beginning on January 1 through December 31 of the year for which it's effective. Can I ask the Department of Labor representatives on, whoever's appropriate, how does the Department of Labor get that out when the minimum wage changes? Is it through the kind of posters that you've talked about? Do you do a notice to employers? And is that something we may have missed in our cost estimate for recurring costs?
Joe, I'll take the first part of that. I mean, we here would calculate it, which is easy enough and cost-free. I'm not sure how the employers would get notified, so I'll punt over to Joe for that part.
Joe or Anna, how do you get word out to employers once the minimum wage changes?
My apologies. I had it on mute and I was talking here. We do post it on our website, and we make it available on the website, but we also do many visits, and we supply employer packets with these posters in them. They are required posters. We've got seminars where people come to our educational seminars, and we hand them out then. They're just open to the public, so we hand them out to whoever we can.
Okay. If for some reason we have a deflation and the cost of living goes down, does the minimum wage go down? Based on the language here?
That is a good question, Lieutenant Governor, and came up once in a discussion, and I have to admit, on the clear reading of the bill, since we don't say otherwise, to clarify an intent that it would only go up, it would apparently go down. I would point out, though, since 1959, that has only happened once when we had our great recession in 1987. Correct me if I'm wrong, Dan.
No, that sounds right. I'd have to verify, but I was going to make that same comment that it almost never happens.
Okay. And so the question of whether or not
it would came up, and it you know, my recollection is it did happen that one time when we had the great oil shock back then, and nationally the only time it's happened was 2009. Since 1960 anyway, I believe.
Okay. So the factors that would go into calculating the minimum wage are the statutory floor that's set here, the statutory floor of a dollar more than the federal minimum wage, and a CPI that is based on local CPI, whether it goes up or down. So conceivably, the CPI could go down, and the wage wouldn't go down if the federal law had gone up, as an example. Okay. All right. Those are the questions that I had, and as I've stated before, when I'm asking questions, I'm not trying to sway the argument one side or the other. I'm just trying to get intent and mechanics on the record. And likewise, when we have testimony by state officials, that's also to answer factual questions, and again, not to argue for or against the initiative. And I make that disclaimer because in another one of these hearings coming on, I've had a question of whether or not providing some of these numbers, these kinds of numbers and so forth, is trying to sway the vote one way or the other. And I want to make it very clear that we are very happy that any factual studies or bases that Ed, you as a proponent, or Denny, you as an opponent or a citizen, would like us to include on the website of the record of these hearings, we're happy to include it in the record. And Ed, I thank you for correcting the record earlier today. Now I'm going to say to people here in the room or to people online, if there's anyone who would like to ask questions of either the opponents, or the experts from the state, the floor is open to you, or if you'd like to testify for or against the proposed legislation. Is there anyone here wishing to testify or ask questions? Hearing none in the room, is there anyone online who'd like to testify or ask questions? And Ed and Denny, I would say that this is an appropriate time for you to ask questions of each other if you have any questions of each other you'd like to get asked and answered on the record.
No, I don't think so. What about you, Denny?
I've got no questions to get on the record right now.
We had so much fun with you the other night, I just wanted to make sure I made that offer again.
Well, we appreciate that.
Yeah. All right. Hey, I'm going to call this hearing to a close, and our next hearing on this initiative is Tuesday in Anchorage at noon at the Denina Center. And if you stay around through the weekend, we'll see you then. If not, we'll have you or a representative online. And I would encourage both opponents and proponents of this legislation to get the word out. This is a good way for Alaskans to be aware of what's in the bill and how it affects them. Thank you very much, and we stand adjourned.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lieutenant Governor. Talk to you next week.
Look forward to it. Thanks. Bye.
Yep, thank you.
Bye-bye.